listening to the Whale Scout Podcast with your host, Whitney Neggebauer.
Welcome to the Whale Scout Podcast, everyone. My name is Whitney Neggebauer, and today is May 20th, 2020. And today we have a very special podcast. We have Deborah Giles from Wild Orca and Kurt Beardsley from the Wild Fish Conservancy. Recently, Wild Fish Conservancy had filed a lawsuit against NOAA Fisheries for authorizing a Chinook salmon fishery in Southeast Alaska. And it states that the agency admits that this fishery is contributing to the decline of southern resident killer whales and Chinook. So first, Kurt, I'd like to welcome you to the podcast. This is your first time joining us today. Could you give us a little bit of background about the Wild Fish Conservancy and how this lawsuit fits in with your mission?
Sure. Well, first of all, Whitney, thank you very much for including us in this very important issue. How does it fit into our mission? We are a wild fish conservation ecology organization, and this is our 31st year of existence. We're a science-based conservation organization where actually wild fish are our client and not fishermen, and we believe that if wild fish do well, then so will wild fish and also the ecosystems and the other species that depend on them. So when we saw this fishery, we've been watching fisheries over time and seeing that the allocation of fish harvest is not always consistent with the needs of recovery of the fish themselves, nor of species that are dependent on them, such as killer whales. And we just, every 10 years, the Pacific Salmon Treaty goes through another review and approval and ratification. And the Pacific Salmon Treaty is an agreement between Canada and the U.S. And what triggered our lawsuit was after the Pacific Salmon Treaty was ratified, then NOAA is requested to, or is required to actually go in and look at different portions of the treaty and see if they meet the needs of threatened and endangered species. And they do a biological opinion on that. And they did a biological opinion on Alaska's portion of the harvest. And they admitted that that they could not bring the parties to reduce harvest enough to meet the needs of wild Chinook recovery or killer whale recovery. And so they needed to mitigate for that. And we felt that that was something that was needed to be challenged, especially when the mitigation they were choosing was to plant more hatchery fish and do habitat restoration. And there's several problems with that. One is hatcheries are identified as being one of the four causes for decline of wild Chinook. And then habitat restoration is great, and we need to do it. But neither of these would be would actually have any results fast enough to ever help killer whales that are actually out there starving today. And in the part, the portion of planting large amounts of hatchery fish would also contribute to the decline of wild Chinook as well. So the solution is part of the problem. And we saw that as an unacceptable. So we filed a 60-day notice back in January asking them to reconsider their biological opinion. And then on March 18th, we filed our complaint. And then because these court proceedings take so long, we felt it was imperative again, considering that the decline of wild killer, or excuse me, of killer whales and their need for food, we filed a preliminary injunction on July 1st to prevent the summer Chinook fishery from occurring. And that's kind of where we are at this point.
So, Giles, could you explain a little bit about why these salmon are so important to southern resident killer whales? Giles, are you there?
Whoops, yep, there I go, just talking into my mute phone. Sorry about
bummer.
That.
That's all right.
So the southern resident killer whales have a fairly extensive range from it's thought that they've been up to southeast Alaska. At least once they've been documented up there in 2007, JPOD was seen up in southeast Alaska. But even excluding that far north reach of their range, they still have a fairly wide range from the Haida Gwaii area of BC, Canada, all the way down to Monterey, California. The summer core critical habitat for these whales is in the inland waters of the Salish Sea, but these whales do range throughout that entire Pacific, along the Pacific coast. And these whales evolved to eat Pacific salmon that would have had, that whose origins were in those rivers all the way from, rivers emptying into the Monterey Bay all the way up to, as I said, the Haida Gwaii, Queen Charlotte Islands, and maybe even a bit farther north. So these whales are accustomed to having fish available to them from different rivers from different times of the year. As the whales leave the Puget Sound region in the fall, early winter, late fall, they are out there along the Pacific coast looking for salmon that are heading back to their natal rivers. Well, regardless of where the fish ultimately end up back in their natal river, almost all of the fish that leave their natal river from the middle of Oregon on up go into the Pacific and then head north up into Alaska to get big. And so the fish are heading up into Alaska to feed on that cold, nutrient-rich water. For anywhere it's probably more like 2 to 5 years now. It used to be upwards of 7 or 9 years that these fish would have been going up that high. But regardless, the fish, wherever they're coming from along much of the southern residents' range, the fish are going to Alaska to get big before they turn back around to head for their natal spawning rivers. And that's where the whales can intercept them is as the fish are coming back towards their natal rivers. So when we think about the fish leaving this area, going north for a number of years to get big, if too many of them are caught there, then not enough of them are making it all the way down here to the southern residents' range where they can be intercepted down here.
And so, Kurt, sort of at the heart of this issue is a mixed stock fishery. And for those out there who do not know what that is, could you explain a little bit what a mixed stock fishery is and what you're doing to help protect the salmon in those fisheries?
Sure. Yeah, Whitney, you're really at the heart of the issue, absolutely. As Giles was explaining, our Chinook from Oregon, Washington, in British Columbia, they migrate up the coast, as she was explaining, going up. Actually, they migrate up and down the entire coast for, much of their lives. Chinook are very different than our other salmon because they are the oldest. They have the oldest life history, as Giles explains. Historically, they would return to spawn anywhere from 2 years old to 9 years old. And it's a diversity of, some of them are genetically programmed to come back that, 2 or 3 years old, and some were programmed to come back at a much later date to be much older. So we have this diversity of the species. When we actually fish in the nursery, the main nursery is right off of Southeast Alaska. The fishermen are fishing on top of immature fish, some mature fish, and fish that are from everywhere. They are commingling together. Fish from Oregon are commingling with ones from British Columbia. And it is impossible for the fishermen to be able to separate out and only catch those fish that are from Alaska, or only catch those fish that are from healthy stocks. A really big point that I want to make sure I make here is the problem we're suing over is not, this is not the fault of fishermen. It is the fault of fish managers, of NOAA and fish managers. When we allow fishermen to fish in regions that do not allow for the fishermen to catch fish from their region, the problem ends up escalating over time. What happens is when you fish in the nursery constantly, you end up changing the actual salmon themselves. The longer you fish in a nursery, the more likelihood you're going to be taking out fish that have a destiny to be older. So if you're constantly fishing in that nursery, fish that have a genetic destiny to be young have a greater likelihood of surviving and coming back to spawn. Ones that are to be much older have a much less likelihood. So over time, you actually shrink the Chinook itself. So when we go back to what killer whales require, killer whales need large Chinook, or they prefer large Chinook. When we look at the data, you know, from like 1920 to 1975, Chinook shrank in size, physical size, roughly by half, from an average 20 pounds in the 1920s to around 10 pounds in 1975. That's a drastic change. And along with losing size, you end up losing diversity. You end up losing reduced fecundity of those fish. We mean the amount of eggs that an older fish has far more eggs than a younger fish. And an older fish also can spawn in areas a younger fish can't, because they're physically much larger and they can dig deeper nests or reds. So we are not only over-harvesting, but we're also changing the actual salmon itself when we fish in those areas. And that said, what we're seeing today is just a reflection of, you know, over 100 years of fishing in the ocean. Actually, it's, again, fishing in the nursery. And what we need to learn from this is we can still fish. We just need to move our fisheries in or near our rivers of origin. So fishermen are fishing on fish from their local regions, and it'll give coastal communities a much greater control over the destiny of their own rivers. Anyway.
Giles, what has been the impact of this reduction in size of the prey that southern resident killer whales are going after?
Well, I think it's having impacts on the population, on the individuals, and therefore the population in so many different ways. Number one is for a whale that evolved to find and catch and eat much, much larger salmon, you know, back, many, many, many decades ago, before we overfished these rivers. Salmon in coming out of some rivers and heading back to some rivers would have been 100 pounds or more. But even a fish half that size, a 50-pound salmon, is almost unheard of these days. But when you think about this massive bodied, long lived apex predator, you think about how much food they need, somewhere between 300 and 350 pounds on average per whale per day of food to catch a 50 pound salmon is vastly different energetically than it is to catch that much food, that much poundage in a salmon that weighs 10 or 12 or even 20 pounds. So the whales are having to expend a tremendous amount more energy to find fewer and less lipid-rich or less caloric-rich fish. And so that's having impact on them kind of in the immediate, where they're having to forage a lot more. Therefore, they're not resting as much, we know, during the daytime, at least. They're certainly not, we're seeing them not socializing to the degree that we used to see them. And then a little bit longer outcomes of the lack of quality and quantity salmon are the fact that females are losing their calves. So we know from Dr. Sam Wasser's work, the Orca Scat Project, looking at fecal hormones, pregnancy hormones in that, in the samples, Sam found, Sam and myself and others involved in that study have found that 69% of pregnancies are lost right before the baby is born viable, right after the babies are born. Sometimes they die. For the females that are miscarrying, spontaneously miscarrying their calves, a huge percentage of those are in late-term pregnancy, which is very dangerous for the mom. And it's a lot of energy going into the development of a fetus only to be lost by a miscarriage. And those females that are miscarrying are also shown to be nutritionally deprived. And so the lack of quality and quantity salmon is having this impact on the population, where it's limiting the population's ability to increase because the calves are not being born viable. And so, year after year after year, this is becoming very clearly a big problem with the southern residents. For example, I'm sure your listeners know, but just as a reminder, K-Pod, one of the three southern resident pods, hasn't had a baby be born and lived since 2011. And that's, when you're talking about a population that's struggling to survive, let alone increase, the lack of quality and quantity salmon is the biggest problem these whales are facing.
And so, Kurt, could you explain to us a little bit about the Southeast Alaskan fishery? How many fish are proposed to be taken, and how many of those would you estimate possibly could be potential killer whale food?
Well, that's a tougher question. We do know what the approved allocation is for this year. It's 201,000 adult Chinook. And how many of those would actually be available for killer whales is something that isn't as well known by scientists, because it has to do with where are those fish in their, when killer whales need them. A big point that's been missed that I just want to go back on when we were talking about the mixed stock fishery, and that Alaska is catching other people's fish. A key point here is that the Pacific Salmon Treaty data has shown over time that the majority of the fish that they catch in Southeast Alaska and the troll fishery are not from Alaska, and it's consistently around 97% of those fish are not from Alaska. Roughly 3% are from Alaska. That's an enormous amount of bycatch, I would say it's to anyone, I would think they would assume that was pretty unreasonable. Anyway, that it's not like there was just a minor amount of bycatch. By far, the majority is. And something else that happens there that's driving down these populations is Alaska actually manages many of their fisheries quite well, and I have to hand it to them. They if they see they're not getting enough fish back to their rivers on a daily basis, I mean, day by day, they will shut the river down and make sure that they have enough spawners to meet their spawner recruitment. But the ocean fishery for Chinook, it doesn't stop. It actually goes on for 10 months a year. And much of that is because very few of those fish are actually from Alaska. It's not hurting Alaska to let their fishermen fish out there. And that's having a very deleterious effect as we're talking about right now. And if those fish come back, the other issue is if we actually let them come back to spawn, they will be far more diverse and far larger than they are today. And to the point that Giles was making earlier, we did some calculations. I mean, if we just look at caloric needs, today the average Chinook coming back is like a 3 or 4 year old, more 3 year olds than 4 year olds. A killer whale, an average killer whale today, would need to eat roughly 47 3-year-olds. Or if we let more of them come back that were older, just 6-year-olds, it would take only 9 6-year-olds instead of 47 3-year-olds. That's a lot less effort. You can actually get your caloric intake and still starve to death if it takes more energy for you to acquire that food than you actually get from it. Anyway, so the win-win situation is the same thing happens to fishermen. Fishermen get paid by the pound. And if we let more of our fish come back and we fish in or near our rivers of origin, we will have more large fish. Fishermen will actually be able to catch less fish and get more poundage than they are today. It won't happen overnight, but it will eventually increase, and we believe it'll significantly increase the benefits to fishermen themselves, and then obviously to killer whales and other species that depend on them.
Right. I just want to play devil's advocate here for a moment. Because I've been following these issues for a little while, and I can almost hear the naysayers in the back of my mind who have been saying, you know, we've already cut fisheries. We've already been reducing fisheries. And if we don't catch these fish, perhaps other predators will get them anyway. I guess I pose this question to you, Kurt, and to Giles. What's your response to those sorts of claims?
Shall I go first?
Go ahead.
Okay, thanks. Thank you. Yeah, this is an argument that actually drives me a little bit crazy because we have to think back in evolutionary times and think about the fact that these different ecotypes, so the argument that often gets used is that the fish-eating populations, the Southeast Alaskan fish-eating killer whales and the northern resident killer whales that are more up in the top of Vancouver Island and north from there, that they're preferentially eating the Chinook. They're taking the food out of the southern residents' mouths. That might be true to some degree. But the bigger picture, the bigger answer to this, or the bigger thing to remember is that these three populations of fish-eating killer whales co-evolved together eating Pacific salmon. And in the past, before humans got involved in so many different ways to decimate salmon populations, these three distinct populations of fish-eating killer whales were easily able to survive and not compete with one another for the fish that were there. So in the past, before humans had so much of a hand in the decline of Pacific salmon, these whales would have been fine. There would have been plenty for the southern residents to have. The fact that there's not enough or making it down here, it's not as cut and dry as to say other killer whales are eating them, or other mammals like, you know, sea lions or seals are eating them. The picture's just too big for that. This ecosystem, the worldwide ecosystem, and then broken down into smaller ecosystems, used to work a lot better. There used to be ample large fish making it back to their natal river, and we just don't see that anymore. And a lot of it has to do with this an interesting wording with the Southeast Alaskan fishery, in that any fish that gets caught in Alaska gets to be called Alaskan caught Chinook salmon, for example, in specifically talking about Chinook. That wording doesn't tell you anything about the origin of the salmon. And yet in the general consumer's mind, that Alaskan salmon is equated in most people's minds as being sustainable salmon. But as Kurt mentioned earlier, only 3% of salmon caught in Alaska, Chinook salmon caught in Alaska, are native to Alaska. And those may or may not be sustainable. In large part, they probably are. But the other 97% of fish that are caught in Alaska that get branded Alaskan-caught wild or Alaskan-caught Chinook salmon are quite possibly, in many, many cases, on the endangered species list themselves to some degree, either as endangered or threatened. And the fact that you can go into a grocery store in England or in Portugal, and I have this as firsthand experience from people that have looked, and see Alaskan caught Chinook salmon in these stores or in Costco in Ohio, that tells you where that explains why we are having such a problem. We're not managing our fishery in a way that can help us understand and keep tabs on the fish that are coming back and how healthy those fish runs are. To blame it on other natural predators, other non-human predators, is it's scapegoating. And it absolutely does not tell the whole picture. It washes our hands of being culpable for what's happening out in the natural world. And it's shirking our responsibility.
I couldn't agree more. And it's, yes, just to, are some of these fish going to be eaten by other predators? Absolutely, some of them are going to be eaten by other predators, but it is part of a healthy ecosystem. But that is not to say we shouldn't let more of these come back, because actually the reasons they've had to keep cutting back on harvest is because they are over-harvesting, as it's recognized they're over-harvesting today. We have old growth habitats like on the south, or excuse me, on the west side of Vancouver Island, that are in a UNESCO biosphere that have never been there's no habitat destruction at all, and they're at like 1-3% of the Chinook they had 50 years ago. So the myth of saying that all we need to do is, you know, restore our habitat and we will restore these species isn't true, especially when you realize that an unreasonable percentage of those fish are being harvested in Southeast Alaska. That habitat cannot afford for those to be harvested far away from their communities. We need to let those fish come back to their rivers of origin and give the authority of local communities to say, oh, my Chinook are in serious decline. I need to let those go back up and spawn. Maybe I can harvest some of my sockeye or something like that. But they need to be able to fish with selective gears. That's another big point. But to say they will all be eaten by predators, it just isn't true. I mean, there's always, people are always looking for an excuse. But scientifically, this just, it makes absolutely no sense at all. It does not pan out.
So let's revisit the lawsuit. What is your goal, Kurt, with this lawsuit? Do you want to stop the fishery? Do you want the agencies to go back and reconsider a different allotment, different gear, different location? What is your goal?
Well, we in the short term, we did file for a preliminary injunction to stop the fishery that's going to start up again in July, the July 1st. And it is to make the argument, and I know we can prove our case, that it is much better. It's time for us again to move the fishery from the nursery, from fishing in the nursery, back to where we fished for thousands of years. Let the fish come back to their rivers of origin. Harvest them at the rivers of origin. If they're healthy, let them come back and spawn if they're needed to, if they're in decline. That we need to educate people to the problems that occur out of sight and out of mind in the ocean. These decisions for ocean harvest are not something that most people are aware of. And like Giles is saying, you know, people see that they buy, you know, a Chinook in the grocery store and it's from Southeast Alaska, and they believe that this is, you know, this is a sustainable fishery. And speaking of that too, the world's largest certifiers, like Marine Stewardship Council, actually certifies the Southeast Alaska Trollcat Chinook as sustainable. And we challenged their decision. They allow for a formal process to go in and bring our scientists and talk to their scientists and see if there's a discrepancy in the data. And we did that, and we said, hey, this is what our statisticians are saying. This is the data from the Pacific Salmon Commission. I'm assuming you're working from the same data. And there was a lot of looking at shoelaces, you know, on their side. And eventually they said, you've got to understand, Alaska was our first salmon to certify under the Marine Stewardship Council. And Alaska basically said, you certify all of us or none of us. And the Chinook fishery came along with it. They did not dispute this 97% harvest. No scientists are disputing it today. But that's how bad the certifiers are. They're actually enabling this fishery to go on by branding them as, you know, actually, when we first did our study, they were branding them as wild Alaskan Chinook. And we went to California, Oregon, Washington, and Alaska, went into stores, bought them, and ran the DNA on them. And yes, the data turned out very similar to what the Pacific Salmon Commission shows. The majority of those fish, you know, were not from Alaska. It just verified that you could be in the fanciest of restaurant ordering a wild Alaskan Chinook and thinking that you were doing the right thing, being a responsible person, and you have a far greater likelihood that you are eating a fish that is not from Alaska, and a reasonable likelihood that one of them is a threatened or endangered species. That's concerning, and that enabling of the industry, that has to stop, because that's educating the public in really a wrong way. And so that's one of the things also we're hoping to get out of this lawsuit, is not only get people to start thinking about, we have to fish in different ways, we have to use selective gears, and I mean selective gears, ones that can release fish that are caught that need to go upstream completely unharmed, like reef nets. There's reef nets off Lummi Island right now. It's an ancient technique. And we've also been developing a fish trap. Fish traps used to be used a lot up and down the coast over 80 years ago. They were a devastating tool. But we redesigned them, and we've been doing research on them for 5 years now. And our research, our published research, is showing that we can release non-targeted fish from the fish trap and have essentially no negative impact on them up to 400 kilometers upriver. I mean, just major, major advantage. And this gets to another point, is 50% of those fish that are caught in the Southeast Alaska Chinook fishery are actually from the Columbia. And when you think that if we just let those fish come back down to the Columbia and our fish there, that's where our experimental fish trap is. We could catch those fish, and if in fact they were wild, we would let those fish go completely unharmed. The hatchery fish or healthy wild stocks that are available to harvest could be harvested at that point. And there's basically zero bycatch of threatened and endangered species. If fishing with gill nets, for example, in the same reach, is the release is so unsuccessful that NOAA just says, just keep all the fish you catch, and we'll let you fish for a shorter period of time. This isn't good for fishermen because they get to catch very few fish, and they also do significant harm. Roughly 50% of the fish they're catching are wild and killing and sending to market. If we just change the tools they work with, we can let those fishermen actually fish longer and catch fish that are available to catch, and double the amount of wild fish that are returning to spawn and aiding in the recovery of much needed listage, in this case Chinook. And the carbon footprint, instead of chasing the fish, fossil fuel is the largest expense for fishermen. When many of the fishermen that fish in Southeast Alaska actually winter in Seattle. And so they're motoring up, and then they're chasing these fish around all season and then motoring down. It's a significant carbon footprint per fish. When you let them return to the rivers of origin and fish with selected gears, the gears that we have developed are either solar powered or there's no power at all, completely passive. The fish are never entangled. They're never actually touched by the gear. If a wild fish comes in, you just lift the door. It goes right through. If it's a hatchery fish or harvestable wild fish of a different species, you can take those out. It's time to change, and I think government's going to need to help fishermen transition, help them fund new gear types, for them to enter into basically a new day for how, where, and when we fish. That's going to be good for fish, good for fishermen, and good for coastal communities from, again, in this fishery, from Oregon to Alaska.
Giles, as a orca researcher and scientist, what are your goals in getting involved with this lawsuit, and what are your hopes for the outcome?
So while there are three identified threats to the southern resident killer whale population as identified by NOAA in the recovery plans, toxicants, pollutants and whatnot is one. Vessel presence and associated noise is the second one. And then lack of quality and quantity prey being the third one. Out of all of those, by far the most important and most important one for us to be focusing on at this point is the lack of quality and quantity salmon. So when the whales have enough to eat, toxicants locked up in their system are not as much of a problem as we can see from the very, very chunky, fat, and happy, and productive, reproductively productive mammal-eating Biggs killer whales. Also, we know from fecal hormones that vessel presence and associated noise is not, and it doesn't spike the stress hormones in the same way with the southern residents, at least when they're getting enough to eat. So all of the science is showing that the needs of the whales right now are most, it's most important for us to be focusing on fish recovery. And so as a killer whale person, killer whale focused person, I have to be paying attention to their food. I have to be paying attention to all of the threats and logically the most attention to the most important or the most, the biggest thing that's making this population not recover and in fact decline. So I think it doesn't make sense for me not to get involved. I wish other people would get more actively involved in this issue because it's something that if we don't recover these whales, the food for these whales, we're just, it's ridiculous to think that we can recover the whales themselves. And so I think that there's been a lot of work on vessel impacts and trying to mitigate the impacts of vessels. There's been some really great work in the state of Washington following the governor's killer whale task force with regard to toxicants into the system. And now we, it just makes logical sense that my attention would be kind of laser focused on making sure that the whales have enough to eat. Wholesale changes in the way that we're doing business and how humans are harvesting the natural resources right now, we have to be shining a light on all of the ways that we're impacting the ecosystems that are important to these whales, because ultimately it matters for us as well. So it's not just salmon that I'm incredibly interested in trying to recover. It's other things like forage fish. The herring here in the Salish Sea and in BC, Canada is another issue that's really important that we need to be focusing on. So trying to make sure that we're not taking out of the ecosystem or out of the food web these critical components of the food web that ultimately are going to lead to the demise or the recovery of the southern residents. And ultimately, our well-being as humans that also rely on the marine realm. So it makes logical sense to be focusing on this issue. And given that the Southeast Alaskan fishery is the biggest impact to the southern residents' diet, it makes sense to turn attention up there.
Well, I'm sure our listeners will be following this issue very closely. Aside from being really careful about or just frankly not eating king salmon at this time, how else could people get involved with this issue?
Well, you say the issue, it's like a giant, it's a giant issue. The lawsuit is going to be very difficult. I would say the best thing I think people could do is actually get involved in understanding more of the effects of overharvest on killer whales. This is really difficult, and you need to share it with your friends too, because there is not a whole lot of information out there that's really clear. For example, the Pacific Salmon Treaty. The Pacific Salmon Treaty is developed basically, by a few individuals, and very, very few people from the public have any idea what goes into the Pacific Salmon Treaty. And we believe these larger negotiations need to incorporate far greater and larger ecological issues like the survival of southern resident killer whales. We need to have our representatives to the treaty be ecologists. We can't have them be individuals that have an interest in commercial fishing like we do today. When the ecosystems are healthy, our salmon and killer whales will be healthy, and we will be healthier. And that's, I would say, if anything, it would be to encourage our representatives, like our governor, to appoint representatives that are far more ecologically and in tune, more literally, ecologists than fishery managers.
Giles, I'll pose the question to you as well. How else do you think our listeners might be able to get involved and help?
I think educating themselves and then educating their family members is number one. Number two is getting involved in groups like yours, honestly, Whitney. I've been, since you've been getting people organized and planting trees along rivers, I think that I've been telling people that as long as you've been doing it. It's real life, hands in the dirt, boots on the ground, active participation in the recovery of habitats. And the more connected we as individuals become with the natural world, the more the connections become clear. And so being able to actually see the work that you guys do, to be able to participate in the work that you guys and other groups like you do, I think is critical for people all over. No matter where you are, you can do the kind of work that Whale Scout does, getting out there and planting trees or doing river cleanup or beach cleanup. All of those things are incredibly important. And so thank you for being a leader in this region, planting trees for whales and making that connection for the public. And I think getting people involved in that even more is what we all need to be focusing on.
Well, thank you for the plug. I appreciate that. And I appreciate chatting with the two of you and for the work that you both are doing to protect our salmon, protect our ecosystems, protect our killer whales. So thank you very much for coming on the podcast today. And I'd love to share more and learn more from you two again in the future.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much. To learn more about this issue and others, please visit whalescout.org. And there you will find all of our other podcasts. You can have them sent straight to your phone by hitting the subscribe button. Our podcast is also found on iTunes and now on our YouTube channel. Thank you so much for listening today.
Thank you for listening to the Whale Scout podcast. Your voluntary donation goes toward the recovery of whale species and enhanced whale watching opportunities in the Pacific Northwest. Please visit www.whalescout.org for more information.